Hello there. Today is Tuesday, February 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump names a new national security advisor.
He's a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience.
Thousands come out for Not My President's Day rallies.
I'm not afraid to say his name, Donald Trump. No.
Also ahead, a pop singer's legal problems are getting in the way of her career. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has named his new national security advisor. He made the announcement from his Florida retreat, Mar-a-Lago, along the Atlantic Ocean, before returning to the White House Monday. He chose Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, a military strategist who has spent his entire career in the U.S. Armed Forces.
He's a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience. I watched and read a lot over the last 2 days. He is highly respected by everybody in the military, and we're very honored to have him.
McMaster will replace Michael Flynn, the retired Army general that Donald Trump fired a week ago after just 24 days on the job. Joining me now for more on who McMaster is, founder of the National Security Institute and director of national security law and policy at George Mason University, Jameel Jaffer. So what do we know about General McMaster, and what's your view on the choice?
H.R. McMaster is an inspired choice, really a brilliant tactician, a brilliant scholar of military doctrine. When he was an officer in the first Gulf War, he led a armored cavalry troop at the Battle of 73 Easting. 12 of his tanks destroyed 28 Iraqi tanks, 16 APCs, and 30 trucks in 23 minutes. It's pretty astounding success. And then he wrote a book. He got a PhD and wrote a book about what he saw as the errors made by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in not pushing back against LBJ during the Vietnam War. And so a very interesting time, at a time when there are questions about independence of various people within the executive branch. This is a man who called for the Joint Chiefs, the military leadership in the DOD, to push back on the civilian leadership in the White House. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Now, he'll be in the White House as National Security Advisor. It'll be interesting to see what reception he gets from his colleagues in the military. But clearly a very distinguished general and somebody the nation and I think the military will have a lot of respect for. So we'll see what happens going forward.
It's interesting. This president certainly seems to have an affinity or an admiration for bringing people in from the military. It's somewhat unusual.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, as you point out, he's brought in General Mattis to DOD. He's brought in General Kelly at DHS, two generals in the National Security Advisor slot, and their chief of staff, Keith Kellogg, is the lieutenant general. So, no, you're right. There's a lot of generals in this administration, and it's clear the president has an affinity for them.
Do you think that this man, as you said, will be an independent thinker, and if he disagrees with the president, he will say so?
His history certainly suggests that. But, you know, I mean, it's hard when you're in the White House. You are the president's right-hand person on national security issues. You know, I mean, having worked in the White House, I can tell you that when the president's attention shifts to a topic, the entire White House staff's attention shifts to that topic. So now how much of that you can pull yourself away from and try to give the president an independent voice while still maintaining relevance is, you know, to be seen. I mean, clearly this is an administration where the president has strong views and he expects people around him who share his views and share his passion, and they're the ones who generally tend to succeed. And so, you know, where there is some pushback, we'll have to see how that goes. Now, it's also worth noting, though, the president has seen some significant pushback from both General Mattis and at some level General Kelly, and he appears to respect that. You know, when General Mattis said he disagreed with the president on waterboarding during the hearing, the president could have said, well, I just think Mattis is wrong, and he could have even pulled his nomination. Instead, he said, no, you know, I respect General Mattis's view, and I'm going to go forward. At least as of now, they're having a very successful relationship.
It sounded like a couple of the people who turned down the job were not happy that the president was going to keep some of the people that he's already put in the National Security Council. One of them, his advisor, Steve Bannon, a controversial figure in and of himself, and the fact that he actually allowed him into that position with national security has raised some eyebrows. What do you think will be the case going forward now?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard to know how the structure of the National Security Council plays out. It sounds like, you know, General McMaster, like General Flynn before him, indicated he expected some measure of independence. But I think everyone understands that at the end of the day, in the White House, The president runs the shop, and that's just the nature of the business. It was true in the Bush administration. It was true in the Obama administration, and it will certainly be true in the Trump administration. That being said, it is unusual for a person in Mr. Bannon's position to be a formal member of the National Security Council, as he has been in the new organization chart for the National Security Council. And that is unusual. It wouldn't be surprising for a new National Security Advisor to push back on that or to be concerned if they were considering the job. You know, clearly General McMaster has decided to take this job under those conditions. We'll see how it plays out. You know, look, I don't think anybody expected General Flynn to not be in office 26 days into the administration. You know, it's hard to know what happens next in this White House, whether it's Mr. Bannon or Mr. Miller, who's also been controversial, or, you know, somebody else on the National Security Council staff facing challenges. And so we'll just see how things play out. But I do think it is unusual, Mr. Bannon's position on the NSC today.
Is it fair to say that this has been rather chaotic?
Well, look, I think any new administration faces a certain amount of chaos in their first few weeks and months in office. It's not unusual. I do think that this president came in with a fairly new team that was new to Washington. That was part of, frankly, his message coming into the White House, is that I'm going to bring something different, bring a significant amount of change. I do think that with all the attention so intensely focused on the White House, bringing in a very respected general like H.R. McMaster, I think is a real opportunity for the administration to try and right its course. I think you see here, to pick up General McMaster, a real opportunity for the president to try and right the ship, at least in this area.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. National security expert Jamil Jaffer. Here are some of the other stories that we are following at voanews.com. Russia's longtime U.N. ambassador dies suddenly. Trump claims massive immigration into Sweden has been a failure. The U.S.-born panda cub Bao Bao heading back to China. A deadline looms for Dakota Access Pipeline protest camp. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we are joined by G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hey, Lori. Monday was a federal holiday here in America, a day to recognize the birthdays of President George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. So each year, President's Day falls on the third Monday of February.
That's right. Federal holiday. We've got banks closed, stores offering lots of sales.
A lot of our colleagues away.
Absolutely. And lots of interesting trivia people have been posting on social media. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of it.
Sure. So one tweet argued the day doesn't actually celebrate all U.S. presidents, but Presidents Washington and Lincoln only. And another fun fact is the Founding Fathers' actual birthday is February 22nd. Now, my favorite is the one that pointed out there are currently five former presidents alive at the same time for the fourth time in the nation's history.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, well, speaking of presidents, what's the social media chatter about President Trump defending his comments or his, I should say, unfounded comments about Sweden?
Yeah. So, as you can imagine, the online reaction to that comment is more than just jokes. The president tweeted Sunday his previous comment about what's happening in Sweden was in reference to a Fox News segment about the reportedly rising number of crimes in the Nordic country as it accepts more immigrants. Many reporters took to Twitter to share Swedish Foreign Minister's statement on Mr. Trump's tweet. The minister said his ministry and its embassies are working hard to disseminate an accurate and fair image of Sweden, and that unfortunately they are seeing a general upward trend in inaccurate information.
All right. Well, anything interesting happening in the world of entertainment?
Yeah, absolutely. So American actress Angelina Jolie's interview with BBC is trending because it's one of the first times that she mentioned her separation from Brad Pitt. And also she discussed her upcoming film set in Cambodia. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. Follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, as G mentioned, Monday was a federal holiday, President's Day, but thousands of protesters rallied nationwide to oppose the Trump administration during Monday's President's Day holiday.
We refuse a fascist America. No, no, no.
Well, the Not My President rallies had demonstrators gathering across the country to support people of color, immigrants, Muslims, workers, LGBTQ people, and also these Native Americans who were angry over the president's decision to move forward with an oil pipeline that runs through part of their sacred land in the state of North Dakota.
We're standing here for a reason, in unity and solidarity. I just want to say that this day is not a federal holiday that I choose to celebrate. It does not represent what's supposed to be the greatest country in the world, democracy, which is supposed to benefit the people. But if you guys have forgotten, this country was founded on genocide. 500 plus years of indigenous resistance, and we're still here. I'm still here.
Well, events took place from Boston to Seattle, where protesters said they hoped to make it to an anti-Trump day, or make it an anti-Trump day. A list of cities on the Not My President's Day Facebook page showed at least 30 cities where protests took place. In 1 month of his presidency, Donald Trump has signed executive orders and memoranda, including a temporary ban on travelers from 7 Muslim nations. Now, that order was blocked by federal judges. There have also been what appears to be an uptick in deportations. Joining me now to talk about that, Christopher Wilson, Deputy Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, where he leads the Institute's research and programming on regional economic integration and U.S.-Mexico border affairs. Thank you for being with us. So the immigration executive order, what exactly does it mean, and is it actually being enforced?
There's a lot of uncertainty about the way that it's being enforced or not yet being enforced. There's obviously been a lot of coverage of a series of immigration raids or immigration enforcement actions where ICE has been working throughout the interior of the United States to remove people that are here and without authorization. The majority of the removals have focused on those with a criminal record, which fits in line with both the executive order and with what has been stated, you know, by the president and those in his cabinet. But, you know, it hasn't been exclusively focused on those people. That was about 75% of those who have been removed recently or have been apprehended recently did have a criminal record. Criminal record that ranges from, you know, what I would say is a relatively minor offense, like driving under the influence of alcohol, up to very grave offenses like homicide. But there's also several who had things like they had been previously deported and then returned to the United States, or simply had an order for removal, which is a deportation order from a migration judge. Now, ICE states that this really is not based on a new executive order, that these are immigration enforcement actions that have been under a planning process and really fit within the priorities that they were given previously. But several, you know, outside analysts are not sure about that. That's because we had really, by the end of the Obama administration, seen a very strong focus on removing unauthorized immigrants that had a criminal record, and specifically a criminal record that involved violent crime. And so that's where the uncertainty lies, is really what are the enforcement priorities right now based on the executive order and just based on the way that the new administration is choosing to implement existing law. The executive order doesn't change law. It just gives guidance about how to implement current law.
I know you've also been doing a lot of research on the issue of trade with Mexico. Trade is a big deal to this new administration. They've talked about renegotiating NAFTA. What is some of your research finding in regard to U.S.-Mexico trade?
You know, obviously, Mexico became a very big topic during this last presidential campaign cycle, and Mexico was in many ways made out to be the problem in terms of a loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States, the movement of some companies, you know, offshoring their businesses to locating countries, including Mexico, abroad. The thing about that is that paints Mexico as our competitor, as the problem, essentially. And so if that's the case, then the solution is to reduce ties or cut off ties with Mexico. My research shows a very different type of relationship between the United States and Mexico. It shows one in which the United States and Mexico actually are co-producing goods. So we have manufacturing plants on both sides of the border that are buying parts and materials from one another, that are, you know, not just trade in the sense that the United States makes something and sells it to Mexico or vice versa, but that we're actually building products together, which means that we're you know, our competitiveness is linked, and we're actually exporting goods to countries, you know, beyond the region outside of the United States and Mexico. Found that there are 5 million jobs in the United States that depend on trade with Mexico. And what that means is that, you know, if we take actions to reduce the amount of trade between the two countries, if we put up large tariff barriers for trade between the United States and Mexico, we're actually, you know, putting at risk, potentially, depending on exactly how things happen, but potentially putting at risk a large number of United States, you know, American jobs. And so half of U.S.-Mexico trade is actually trade in parts and materials or inputs. So, you know, we're sort of feeding and giving sustenance to the production processes, the factories on the other side of the border in both directions. And so it's really, based on all the research that I've been doing, it's much more of a mutually beneficial relationship than one that is a zero-sum game where one side wins and one side loses based on a transaction. And so all that means is that if we're considering putting up trade barriers, we need to be very careful about how that happens so that we don't inadvertently end up hurting the United States economy. It's probably not in the United States' interest really to damage the Mexican economy either. And so thankfully, all these things actually do align in the sense that there is a path forward. There's been a lot of talk about a renegotiation of NAFTA as a possibility. And that's certainly something that could be done in a way that's beneficial to both the United States and Mexico and Canada. NAFTA was negotiated 25 years ago. And so there were plenty of things that weren't included in that agreement simply because they didn't exist then. You know, we didn't use smartphones on a regular basis. Businesses didn't use online platforms to connect buyers and sellers. A lot has changed. And so there's plenty of space for an update. There is a real challenge in the United States in that we are losing manufacturing jobs. That's been a long-term 30-year trend. It's mostly driven by technological advance and automation, which means that we can, you know, make more stuff with less people. But trade does play a role in it. That accelerates that trend. When we open our doors to trade, our workers face competition. And so what's really needed, you know, probably more than changes to the agreement itself in terms of NAFTA, is a big emphasis on workforce development. U.S. workers can compete and are willing to compete, but they need to be given the tools to compete. And so if we're in a period, which we are, of major economic transformation, it's really vital that we find ways to give our workers the tools to move through these periods of transformation so they don't feel left behind and so that they don't then feel frustrated with issues of trade and globalization and demand sort of a radical reworking of a system that in many ways is working well, but in some ways has in fact failed them.
All right. Chris Wilson, Deputy Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We appreciate your time. Thank you. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, coming up, a court battle that's hindering a rising pop star's career. But first, this story. Water can be dangerous stuff for people when it freezes and falls from the sky, covering the ground with snow or ice. It's perhaps even more dangerous and can cause significant damage when it falls as rain and then freezes on the ground. And while most of us are smart enough in the U.S. to come in out of the cold, trees obviously can't do that. And scientists are now trying to discover how trees react when they're suddenly covered with ice. VOA's Kevin Enochs reports.
Ice and automobiles do not go together well. But what about ice and trees? Scientists at the U.S. Forest Service decided to find out how trees respond when they get covered in a heavy coating of ice.
I was actually on the road going to a scientist meeting, and I was going through the Berkshires, and I was just firsthand experience of seeing all the cars sliding off the road and seeing the devastation to the forest. And I looked at that, and I thought, oh, my goodness. I mean, this is something we really need to know more about.
But fortunately, ice storms don't happen all that often. So Lindsay Rustad and a Forest Service colleague decided to create their own in an outdoor forest laboratory.
And we said, well, we both work in one of the most famous outdoor laboratories in the world. So instead of going to ice storms or waiting for an ice storm to come to us, we decided we would make ice storms.
That's not an easy thing to do.
We have two of these pumping vehicles going up and down the length of our basketball size courts, and they're spraying in arcs kind of at each other, but it's perfectly choreographed.
The goal is to understand how trees respond to a coating of ice. Ice storms, like most other weather events, are expected to become more common and more extreme as the climate continues to get warmer.
We want to understand that ability of trees to rebound from things, even some things that look somewhat devastating. But we also know that that ability to rebound is not, you know, infinite.
So far, the data suggests that the more ice that falls or freezes, the harder time trees will have recovering. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
Well, while the music world often appears glamorous and fun, a dark underbelly of the business sometimes revealed to the public. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald reveals the latest details to VOA's Jim Stevenson about an ongoing court battle that's muting an artist's career.
Stars fall at my feet, keep me grounded as I reach.
Kesha and Dr. Luke have been very publicly at each other's throats since late 2014, and the latest round was fired this week when Kesha's lawyer released several emails from producer Dr. Luke, which seemed to back up Kesha's claims of abuse during her time working with him. Now, these emails were released in a bid to convince the judge to release Kesha from her contract with Dr. Luke. That's what she's wanted all along. These emails were filed in a New York court, and they have Dr. Luke defending himself. One of the emails has Dr. Luke defending himself to Kesha's manager, Monica Cornia, after he confronted Kesha about breaking her diet. Now, Kesha says Dr. Luke always gave her a hard time about her weight. He says it almost drove her to suicide. Luke said in the email that Kesha had had a Diet Coke and a sandwich when she was supposed to be on a juice fast. And another letter said that songwriters and producers didn't want to work with Kesha because of her weight. Now, Dr. Luke's team claimed these emails were taken out of context. They just took little bits and pieces of them. The whole thing is misleading. And they said Kesha herself was the one concerned about her weight. Kesha says that at one point, Dr. Luke called her a refrigerator. She says she struggled with eating disorders in the past. She says these emails back up claims that he was both sexually and emotionally abusive to her. Now, the reason these emails were released is that a few days prior to that, Dr. Luke launched a counterclaim against Kesha saying she owes him $1.3 million in royalties. This thing went nuclear a long time ago. It all started in 2014 when Kesha sued to get out of her contract, alleging repeated sexual and emotional abuse from Dr. Luke, allegations which he has constantly denied. Last year, Kesha lost her bid to get her release from Dr. Luke's label, Kemosabe. It turns out the judge who threw out Kesha's case is married to a lawyer for Sony, which owns Kemosabe Records. However, the judge later said her husband specializes in healthcare law. He's one of hundreds of lawyers. There was absolutely no conflict of interest. And in fact, Kesha's attorneys said they were not the ones who raised the issue. It was raised by the New York Post. So that's a side issue. The main issue here is that Kesha desperately wants to get out from Dr. Luke's thumb. Dr. Luke says Kesha is free to record whenever she wants, with whomever she wants. Kesha says this is not the case. She is continuing to make music, but on a very limited basis. Her career has effectively stalled these last 2.5 years.
Join Ray McDonald every week for the Top 20 Countdown every week on VOA 1, and follow Ray on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.